including one that is going to make finding things out about the province more difficult for reporters and the public. In March, Doug Ford announced that his government was going to change freedom of information laws to exempt correspondence from himself and his cabinet ministers. These changes came after a court ruled that Ford's personal cell phone records were subject to information requests. It's been known for a long time that Ford conducts provincial business on his personal phone, so obviously, reporters have been trying to get to that. Now, if these new rules are put in place, they can't. Not only will new requests be denied, but the exemption will be applied retroactively, which will kill any requests journalists have already made. Joining me to talk about these proposed changes is the Trillium's Queen's Park reporter, Jack Howen. Jack joined me at the Toronto Reference Library on Wednesday, April 1st for this conversation, so there is no mention of Doug Ford's latest announcement to change regional government by slashing councils in Simcoe and Niagara and giving an appointed regional chair strong chair powers. This new development was announced Thursday afternoon before the long weekend. Jack Howen, welcome to Sources.
Thanks for having me.
Queen's Park is back in session. A lot of changes over the last couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah.
Queen's Park only sat for about 51 days last year, and they came back this spring and hit us with a wave of different changes, including one that might make the job of a reporter in Ontario a little bit more difficult. You know, it's never been particularly easy being a reporter in Ontario. But what can you tell me about these proposed changes to the Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act in the province that are going to change things?
Yeah, so it might sound a little arcane or in the weeds, but it does matter. So stay with me. So FIPA, the act that you mentioned, governs what records are to be publicly disclosed upon request. So it's a key tool for journalists to see what the government is doing at any given point. To look at emails, to see calendars, to see meetings, to see memos, briefing notes, to get at the why of why government decisions are made. Up until now, we've been able to request records from the Premier's office and all of his ministers and parliamentary assistants and any other governing MPP. The changes that the Ford government is proposing would axe all of the Premier's office, all of his ministers, and all of his parliamentary assistants' records from FIPA. So we wouldn't be able to take that look behind the scenes to see what they're talking about amongst themselves, how they're being briefed, and the meetings that they're having with other people who might influence government policy.
Right. And I mean, every journalist has to make records requests like this. And we've all written stories that are based off of briefing notes and correspondence. I'm personally not feeling great about it. Where does this leave people who have active record requests involving cabinet ministers and the premier?
Yeah, so a key part of it is that it's retroactive. So if you've requested a record in the premier's office and it's been denied and it's under appeal, or it's still working its way through the very lengthy process, which is supposed to take 30 days but never does, then it's going to be killed. It's going to be stopped in its tracks. So a major example of this is Global News's fight to get the premier's call logs on his personal cell phone, which might sound really invasive at first glance. I wouldn't want my personal call logs out there. But the key thing is that Doug Ford uses his cell phone to talk to everyone. He uses it to talk to constituents, random people that text him. He gives out his phone number all the time, but he also uses it for government business. This is something his lawyers in the court battle over releasing these documents have actually admitted. So he uses it for everything, and now we won't be able to see who he's talking to.
Right. And I mean, for the folks at home, Press Progress did that story about Doug Ford leaving a voicemail on a worker's worker's phone, where he very politely suggested if they didn't like it, go find another job. And that was from a specific phone that I believe was his personal phone.
I mean, odds are, yeah, if he's using it, it's the phone at issue.
So people have freaked out, and I think correctly, about this announcement by the Ford government. But I want to put it into perspective how much this could hamstring reporters focusing on the province. How does this change your day-to-day if you're not able to use information requests?
Yeah, so Well, I will still be able to use information requests to request a lot of other things. As I've been saying to my colleagues, you better learn to speak municipal FOI, buddy, because there's going to be a lot more of them, and ministry FOI and that thing, and that type of thing. So there are a lot of ways that this is going to change our day-to-day. So I think the best way to illustrate it would probably be to talk about stories that we've done that we wouldn't have been able to do if this change had been in place. So a lot of Greenbelt stories had to do with staffers in the premier's office and in other ministers' offices talking to each other, talking to landowners, that kind of thing. So we were able to see who was talking to who and how that played out. Just recently, we did a story on how the premier's chief of staff at the time was holding weekly bike lane meetings with cabinet office, with the Ministry of Transportation during the bike lane lawsuit that the Ford government is still embroiled in. It will also kill, as my colleague Charlie Pinkerton pointed out in a recent story, any way to see exactly who the Ford government ministers met with at any given time. So federally, lobbyists have to disclose every month the meetings that they've had with government officials. That's not the case here, but there's a roundabout way of getting at that information, which is to request the ministers' calendars so you can see the meetings that they've scheduled. Those will no longer be subject to FIPA. So while we will still be able to see who's on the lobbyist registry, we won't be able to see when they met with government officials, what they talked about, and what the timing of those meetings might suggest about other things. Back in 2023, when they were making a bunch of changes to pharmacist prescribing powers, which has really benefited shoppers, blah, blah, after they made that initial wave of changes, the health minister met with the president at the time of Shoppers a few months after those changes were made. And Global got this story. And so based on a briefing note in the health minister's office, they said that they were going to talk about enhancing further the primary care system of Ontario. As far as Shoppers was concerned, they were only going to talk about the pharmacy changes that had already been made. So it's those type of stories that hint at, you know, the government's plans, that explain what the government is doing, that maybe it doesn't want to tell you about, that we're going to lose access to.
The Trillium has been doing such great work on chasing down recipients of the Skills Development Fund over the last, half a year now, it feels like. How would that be affected?
Yeah, so we've done some FOIs with the Labor Ministry to get at data for the Skills Development Fund, so those would not be affected. But what would be affected is records in the Labor Minister's office. So, like I said, we wouldn't be able to see who Labor Minister David Piccini has met with, if he's had meetings before giving large grants to certain groups. We did a story based on donors who received SDF funds, PC donors. And a big part of that story was a meeting or a fundraiser that the Carpenters Union held for David Piccini. So I think we may still have been able to get at that story by going in person to Elections Ontario and rooting our way through the records, but we wouldn't be able to see David Piccini's calendar for his attendance or anyone else's attendance at that fundraiser.
Mm-hmm. I feel like sometimes these stories come together on a detail that comes out of something that you're able to sort of cross-reference with another thing. And you're like, oh, there is a connection here.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think we should talk about the Information and Privacy Commissioner. There have been two statements from the IPC. I don't recall ever seeing two statements about proposed changes in my career as a journalist, but I'm going to throw a quote at you. The proposed changes to Ontario's Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act would diminish the public's right to information by excluding from the law all government records held by the premier, cabinet ministers, parliamentary assistants, and their political staff. This sweeping exclusion, especially when applied retroactively, raises serious concerns about the future of Ontarians' right to transparency, privacy, and independent oversight. And this was in like a fact check of several things that Ford had said publicly about these proposed changes. How should we understand this pushback from the Information and Privacy Commissioner? And was there anything about either statement that stuck out to you specifically?
Yeah, she's really come out swinging against these changes. And it makes sense because this is the point of her office, is to protect the public's right to know about stuff. Ford has said it's unfortunate that she's politicizing the process, which, you know, you can make up your own mind about that. But she's put out these fact checks that have undermined all of the Ford government's stated reasons for making this change. So one of them, famously, Doug Ford said, "We got to protect ourselves from communist China," which was roundly mocked on Twitter. People pointed out that if communist China is filing FOI requests and waiting 6 months for a response, then perhaps they aren't as big of a threat as we thought. But, you know, to seriously engage with it, the IPC actually noted that these changes would undermine cybersecurity because government ministers would no longer have to keep their records on secure devices and follow secure document protocol. They could just be talking about government business on their personal phones, like the premier likes to do, which are much more susceptible to hacking, leaks, that kind of thing. The main thing the government has said is that this legislation is old and they need to update it and they need to get more in line with the rest of the provinces, which have tighter Freedom of Information Acts. There's some truth to that, but a lot of it is not true. As the IPC pointed out, Ontario's cabinet confidence laws are already broadly in line with a bunch of other provinces, BC, Alberta, Manitoba, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Newfoundland and Labrador, Prince Edward Island, and the Yukon. And even the feds, which have a much more restrictive FOI regime, Ontario's proposed changes would make things tighter than the federal laws. The other major reason that Doug Ford has said that we have to change these laws is because he's admitted that it's about his personal phone. He said that, you know, he gets a lot of texts. 90-some-odd% of the texts that he get are from just constituents, people complaining about stuff, people telling him about their personal problems. And he says that can't get out into the public sphere. And there's a reason that he hasn't said this stuff is getting out into the public sphere and we need to stop it. And it's because that stuff is already exempt from FIPA. You can't FOI Joe Schmo down the street's health records that he texted the premier and then splash it on the front page of the newspaper. Not that any journalist would, but that's the accusation that Ford has leveled against journalists. He said that you guys would get AIR health records and that kind of thing. The law was written by smart people and they already baked in obvious exclusions, which include cabinet confidence, things that relate to laws that cabinet talks about amongst themselves. You know, they need to be able to have a certain level of privacy to talk about all the bad options, to talk about potential, to not hold back in those discussions. And that stuff is already exempted. So the government is proposing to go way further and exempt everything else. And the IPC is taking a lot of issue with that.
Right. And I think those two excuses that you brought up are the two toughest for me to swallow. One, Doug Ford's appeal to privacy. And then we got to be worried about China. But genuinely.
Yeah, I would bet that he regrets saying that. But he's trying to talk about cybersecurity, I would bet. And but it would have the opposite effect, as the IPC said. Oh, and the other thing he said is that we get way too many FOI requests. We get 75,000 a year. That's more than the rest of the country combined. That would be an insane number if it were true, but it's nowhere close to true. The real number as of 2024 is about 28,000 that the province gets. What the premier appears to have done is taken what the province gets and what all municipalities in Ontario and police forces and all municipal level things get, which they handle, not the province, and added those numbers together and then added 5,000 on top of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, it reminds me of like the way that they counted their housing numbers when they're, you know, they're tracking it. They're like, oh, we can add long-term care units and any basement suites as well. That's
dorms.
Dorms, yeah, you know.
And they're still at just over a third of our target.
Yes. Yeah, they've moved away from the 1.5 million. And
yeah, they'll never out and out say that 1.5 million is dead and gone, but the finance minister said recently that he's not focused on it. And when I fairly aggressively said to the housing minister in a scrum, assuming the 1.5 million target is dead and gone, he didn't take issue with that. But he did say every little bit helps, which I think is also pretty instructive about where we're at.
As you mentioned before, Colin DeMello and Isaac Allen at Global have been after Ford's cell phone records. I'm also assuming that you and your colleagues at the Trillium are chasing other leads on Doug Ford. Of course, you know, these changes are applied retroactively to information requests that have already been put in Do you think it's outside the realm of possibility that these proposed changes to FOIs has something to do with a request that has already been made by a journalist or a member of the public?
I mean, I can't, again, know what's in Doug Ford's head, but like I said, he has admitted that it is partially, at least, about his phone records. The excuses that he's come up with as to why his phone records should not be public don't hold water, and he clearly doesn't want to release them.
Was an excerpt from a new episode of Press Progress Sources. Find out more at pressprogress.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. And finally, launching in October 2024, news criticism podcast The North State features journalist Scott Martin punching through the noise biweekly and tackling how news media frames issues, omits information, and pushes the status quo. Like on this recent episode featuring a conversation with University of Toronto political scientist Elizabeth McCallion, unpacking the strategy behind Prime Minister Mark Carney's push for a majority government through floor crossing. Now, here's Scott.
The North State is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Well, the mad lad went and did it. After securing 5 MPs from other parties, most notably the Conservatives, the Carney government won 3 more by-elections, bringing the Liberal total to a slim but decisive majority in the House of Commons. This was a foregone conclusion in many ways. After Western Ontario MP Marilyn Gladue left the Conservatives to join the Liberals, the writing was on the wall. There were 2 safe Liberal seats in Toronto and a toss-up in Quebec, but this was a likely outcome. But what does this tactic of floor crossing mean for Canadian electoral politics? Does this mark a change for the Liberals, or does it reflect their history? How will the Conservatives respond to this new government? We're going to get into those very questions today. This is the North State. Prime Minister Mark Carney is in the news lately because a lot of hay has been made about floor crossers. And this is something that has been in the news for a while. And I think it's a subject that deserves a lot more scrutiny because I'm not sure if there's a precedent for this particular government or any government really achieving a majority through floor crossing, but it seems like it could happen now. So I wanted to bring on an expert who could talk about this. Her name is Dr. Elizabeth McCallion. She's a political scientist at University of Toronto. Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm not too bad. It's early Sunday morning. We both got our coffees beside us, I assume. Before we go any further, I do want to do a disclaimer for everybody listening. Elizabeth McCallion is my sister-in-law. Unlike some podcasts, I actually mention when a member of my family is involved in the process at some point. So with that in mind, I don't think it's going to have that much bearing on this conversation here. But just so you all know, this is a conversation that Elizabeth and I have definitely had off the air as well. And hopefully it kind of evolved from that. And I think the point that is probably most important to start with is there's a lot of debate over whether achieving a majority or forming government through floor crossing is democratic or undemocratic. Obviously, this is a big question, but it's probably something that you've thought a lot about. So what are your reflections on the democratic angle of achieving a government, especially a majority government, through these means?
So I teach a lot of courses at U of T about politics and parliament. And this semester, I'm teaching 2 courses on parliament. And so I've been talking to my students a lot about the democratic purposes of our system and kind of how those are borne out in the processes. And we know that the rules and the processes can be have a gap between them. So we have a lot of debates in my classes about what political scientists would call a democratic deficit. The idea that there's a gap between what we expect our democratic systems to do and what they actually do. And so with all of this news of floor crossings, I think there was a time in my life as a Canadian institutionalist when I would have said, this is how the system works. Like, it's the public should know that this is how the system works. We elect 343 MPs and they decide amongst themselves how to form government. And this system has grown out of the British Parliament, which has deep roots in history, like literally back to 1,000 years ago, and has evolved over time and been refined to be this system. After so much teaching and talking to my students, most of them are in their early 20s and have a really good, like, critical perspective, but also they come in sometimes with like an every person's perspective, because they haven't, like, I'm the first one to teach them all these deep things about institutions. And so they're asking questions that I think I probably asked in my undergrad, leading me into concerns about the democratic deficit and how people expect the system to work, which is, we know that voters are considering party as like a primary issue when they're choosing whom to vote for. And so when we look at all these floor crossers like Chris D'Entremont, Michael Ma, Marilyn Gladue, the reason that people voted for them, well, there may be some people in their districts who know them personally and who, like, it's a community thing and they think this person would be good to represent us. The reality is a lot of people don't know their MPs personally and they're voting for somebody based on the party they're affiliated with. And we know the leader of that party is also important. It's all very messy when you think about democratic accountability. We know that these MPs will either need to go up for election again or may not get nominated. People are talking about, like, it seems like it would be very hard to win some of these ridings as a Liberal, particularly Marilyn Gladue's riding out in Western Ontario. The concern for me about the achieving a majority by floor crossing is about the cynicism that it produces in the electorate and in voters when they feel that their political preferences were not respected and they now don't feel like they're getting the kind of representation that they had elected to receive. The problem there is like the cynicism that it produces and the risk of voter apathy going forward. Why would I even spend time expressing my democratic preferences if the elites are not going to listen to them or respond?
Well, and I think it's definitely context dependent for MPs. Like you mentioned Chris D'Entremont, he was very much known as like a red Tory, and on the eastern side, like Maritimes, it's a bit less of a stark divide between, for example, Marilyn Gladue's history and someone like Justin Trudeau. I don't, off the top of my head, obviously it's not directly comparable. And I do want to talk about possibly the down the line effects of this, but I think Marilyn Gladue is the important place to start, not just because it's the most recent at time of recording. I mean, we're recording on April 12th. As far as we know, apparently there are possibly 9 more conservative MPs who are considering crossing the floor. That's according to the Liberal Party, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But in her past, she's espouted very conservative views. She voted against a law that would outlaw conversion therapy. She's been vocal about her personal views about it being anti-abortion. Now, as a result of this floor crossing, there has been reports that she is saying, you know, her personal views don't affect her legislative votes and she'll vote with the party. And she is against conversion therapy now. But this is probably one of the starkest examples that you can have of a conservative from the right wing of the party historically moving over to the Liberals. And I have characterized Mark Carney's government as a right wing party. And I think it's kind of become a cliche now, or a lot of people say it's the most conservative government since Stephen Harper. What does this say about the direction of the Liberal Party and where it stands now, not just in policy, which we can certainly talk about, and I assume we will to fill this out, but the fact that it's accepting people who have historically been on the right wing of the Conservative Party?
It really highlights for Canadians the big tent nature of the Liberal Party. And I think I have some things to say about kind of the Liberal Party in general, as well as the individual representatives who cross the floor and kind of what their job looks like going forward. In terms of the question about how we can understand the Liberal Party and its future, if it's accepting people from the like rightmost wing of the right wing party, political scientists have known for a long time that the Liberal Party basically has no ideological core, and its skill is really in moving around the political spectrum to capture basically the median voters' interests. If we picture the political preferences of voters on a left to right continuum and a normal distribution, which is like what we would call a bell curve, the Liberal Party is really good at capturing that, the height of that bell curve, the most voters who are going to respond to whatever the policy preferences are of the day. So we've seen this in the past. Justin Trudeau and his Liberals ran like to the left of the NDP in the 2015 election. Now we've seen Mark Carney's Liberals accused of like basically copying many, many points from the Conservative Party's platform. So the Liberal Party changes depending on kind of the interests of the public at the time, as well as the leader in charge. And the leader can kind of has a lot of power over how the policies are established and what the plan is. In that way, it's like not surprising that the Liberals have moved to the right under Mark Carney. I think what's like more surprising or concerning for me as somebody who studies this stuff, but also like just as a citizen who has to cast a vote herself, is the convergence between the Liberal and Conservative parties offering no real choice for government otherwise. We know that the NDP and the Bloc saw a lot of losses in the last election. There was a time when the NDP may have looked like a viable alternative for government. We'll see what happens now with the change in party leader. But like the only parties that have ever formed government in Canadian history are the Liberals and the Conservatives. And now we're seeing basically, do you want the same policy platform, but they would be wearing blue or they're wearing red? And so that is like concerning and frustrating, I think, for a lot of citizens who want to feel like they actually have a choice. At the same time, Carney himself is polling very, very well. There's this kind of projection of stability that's being put forward. And the reason for the floor crossings is listed as like, we're going to have a stability under a majority government, which, you know, we can get into all of that too. But like, at what cost? So like, do we want parties to have core principles that they represent that voters can reliably use as a shorthand for their political preferences when they are casting their ballots? So that said, when you look at people who've crossed the floor, some of the red Tories are obviously quite aligned.
It was an excerpt from a recent episode of The North State. Find Scott's writing and the show at thecatch.ca and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcasing, your local campus and community radio station. This episode has been brought to you by Unripped. Learn more about Canada's community of more than 30 progressive publishers and get all your Canadian journalism, including news, videos, and podcasts in one place at unrigged.ca. And by The Alberta Advantage. Find the show's almost 9 years of archived episodes at albertaadvantagepod.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Blue Sky and Instagram for updates on new episodes and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 89 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now, back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
This is Bird Note. Milkweed plants are important to monarch butterflies. Adult monarchs lay their eggs on milkweeds, and their caterpillars feed on the leaves. Milkweed contains a toxin that helps protect the caterpillars from predators. But monarchs aren't the only ones who benefit from milkweed. Scientists in Ohio once tried to document every insect species they found eating some part of the common milkweed plant. They identified hundreds of species, including 132 kinds of beetles alone. And many bees, butterflies, and other pollinator insects visit the milkweed's flowers. Milkweed is almost like a tiny ecosystem of its own, drawing in creatures of all shapes and sizes. When it's part of a diverse community of plants, it helps many species find food and shelter, including birds. The fluffy fibers in a milkweed seed pod are the perfect lining for a songbird's nest. Not to mention, some hummingbirds drink nectar from milkweed flowers. Planting milkweed helps the declining monarch butterfly and a whole host of other species, including birds. Learn how to find seeds for milkweed and other native plants on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.